Ilya Meritz in for Leonard Lopate. My next guest was just 24 years old when he got an unusual invitation to the White House. Valerie Jarrett, an influential advisor to President Obama, was looking for a speechwriter. David Litt had done a little speechwriting and joke writing since graduating from college, and he expected his audition would consist of an interview. Instead, when he arrived, Jarrett's chief of staff sat him down and said, "Why don't you write a two-page speech for a breakfast roundtable with CEOs?" The chief of staff left the room, returning an hour later. Whatever it is that Litt wrote, it must have been at least okay, because he got that job and he spent the next several years writing speeches for many key members of the Obama administration, including, eventually, the president himself. Now David Litt has a memoir of his speechwriting years. It's called Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years, and I'm happy it brings him to our show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what did you write in that audition at the White House?
I wish I fully remembered. It was, as you can imagine, a little bit of a panic. And I think it was, I don't know whether Mike Strautmanis, who was Valerie's chief of staff, knew that this was wildly unconventional for a speechwriting job or not, but it was kind of perfect training for any White House job where you're being presented with things that are patently absurd but important, and you just have to do it. So I think the way described in the book, I was sort of like white-collar MacGyver, just pulling together, you know, economic statistics, other things the president had said, some flattery for the audience. And whatever it was, I guess it was good enough.
Were you allowed to use Google or anything?
Yeah, I was, I Googled furiously. I think that's one advantage that the Obama White House and our team of speechwriters probably had over some earlier White Houses, that there is a lot available on the internet, but it's still, you get to be a very fast Googler, I'll just put it that way.
And I suppose you probably have to use Wikipedia with caution.
You do, yeah. What I found is Wikipedia with caution, but also I talk in the book about how intense our fact-checking process was. And so sometimes you knew that if you pulled something from Wikipedia, the fact-checkers would be like, "Where'd you get that?" And then no one wants to be like, "Well, I saw it on Wikipedia." So you need some source beyond that one.
I learned so much reading this book, including the fact that the White House actually outsourced a lot of its joke writing. That really surprised me. I know Judge Apatow wrote some jokes. How did that work?
There was no sort of formal process where we, you know, opened up a sort of call for writers in Hollywood. But in the same way that I was at the White House because I believed in President Obama and what he was doing, was trying to help, a lot of people from the comedy world said, "Well, this is the way we can help. This is what we do." And one of the fun things about it was, so we would write a lot of the jokes in-house. We'd work with a lot of former Obama staff on the jokes. But we would also then be able to reach out to like some of the people who I admire most in the comedy world and say, "Hey, want to work together on this?" And, you know, if I said that now, they'd be like, "Eh, I don't know, I'm kind of busy." But at the time, they were like, "Yeah, of course." So it was really fun. And it was a pretty special experience to get to be part of that.
Right. You're writing jokes, but you're writing jokes for not exactly just anyone. It's probably for the president of the United States, maybe occasionally for Valerie Jarrett or someone like that. Like, how do you write jokes for people who are not comedians?
Well, we were pretty lucky in the Obama White House. President Obama has a really good sense of comic timing. I mean, he would open for a professional comedian every year. And every year, the professional comedian would say, like, "This isn't really fair, because he can land a joke really well, and also he's the president." Like that seems like an unfair combination. And that's true. One of the things that he understood also is that part of the joke when the president is telling a joke is that it's the president telling a joke.
Right.
So he didn't want to do things where it would have been better for a comedian. Sometimes, you know, I talk in the book about one point when he sort of said, "That'd be funny if a comedian did it," which was a polite way of saying, like, "I'm not going to do that. We should move on." And on the other hand, there were jokes that only he could tell, that wouldn't have been funny if a comedian told them, but were funny because he was playing off his public persona, and he was self-aware enough to understand that.
Well, President Obama was, of course, a very talented writer and orator already when he got to the White House, and I wonder if that made it in some way less challenging or enjoyable than it might have been if you were writing speeches for somebody who was not particularly eloquent.
I think it was more challenging, but also more enjoyable, because on one hand, you knew that President Obama knew good writing when he saw it, and he knew slightly less good writing when he saw it. And so, you know, the way our shop worked is I would send a speech to the chief speechwriter, who's Jon Favreau in the first term and Cody Keenan in the second term, and they would be editing it before the president saw it. But everybody knew that he could tell the difference between something that was so-so and something that was really good. which in some ways is great because that's what you hope for as a speechwriter, but in some ways it forces you to not phone it in, which can be scary. The other thing about writing for President Obama was that when he would make edits, which he sometimes, you know, he'd make some handwritten edits the night before or take out the yellow legal pad and write a paragraph or something like that. And those were almost always the best parts of the speech. Like, those were the parts of the speech where my friends and family would be like, wow, you wrote that? And I'd be like, well, I worked on the speech. Kind of dodge the question a little bit.
What, I mean, what is good speech writing, actually? Because it seems to me that you, the key thing is to sort of be inoffensive, be factual, have the whole thing, like, sort of make sense. And then an afterthought might be actually being stimulating or expressing some interesting idea. Like, how do you balance those things?
The way I wrote about it was that speechwriters are sort of like personal trainers. So I suppose in the same way that if you go to a personal trainer and you get injured, like that, in it, you know, there's a sort of do no harm element to it for sure. But I think the really good speechwriting, and certainly what really good speechwriters can do, is help someone put their best foot forward. So to present the kind of most appealing version of themselves, not somebody they aren't, but the best possible version of the person they are. And particularly for us, I mean, we knew that if President Obama had the time, he could have written better speeches than any of his speechwriters. I think anyone who I worked with would agree with that. But obviously, he had some other things to do. He's like the president, got a lot on his plate. And so to a large extent, the way I thought about my job was, how can I get this as close as possible to what he would have written if he actually had the time to do the research and do the writing himself? Not going to get all the way there, but if I can get 90% of the way there, that would be a win.
So give me some examples. If you're kind of the trainer, and at the beginning you were working for Valerie Jarrett and for Bill Daley, chief of staff, and other people in the White House, and you're really sort of getting, effectively sort of getting to know, like, basically, like, what their fitness goals are for speech making. Like, how did that differ from person to person?
Well, a lot of it just depends on what a person finds exciting and interesting. Because if somebody is talking about something they care about, the audience knows that. And the reverse is true as well. And some of it is also, what are the stories or the anecdotes in a person's past that resonate with audiences? I mean, a piece of advice that Valerie would often give to young people when she spoke to them was something that she, I think, had heard from her grandmother, which was, put yourself in the path of lightning. You know, what she meant was be in a place where things are happening and opportunities will arise. And being able to remember, okay, she said that in a speech and the young people in the audience really responded to that. So without being asked, we'll put it in the next speech and save her time in that way. I think that was the kind of job that a speechwriter does that isn't always as, like, exciting and sort of Rob Lowe and the West Wing. You know, there's not episodes that are so much about that, but that's a big part of what speechwriters can do.
You write that she hated the phrase at the end of the day and also hated ending sentences on prepositions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things that I learned when I started writing speeches was that if a speechwriter and their boss disagree on something, the boss is always by definition right. And for example, like in the case of at the end of the day, I think Valerie is also right on the merits technically. That, you know, it's kind of
a cliche.
Yeah,
like
it's a cliche phrase.
At this point. Yeah.
I happen to love it.
Yeah.
I like in my own
really?
Personal writing or in my own when I just talk, you know,
yeah.
I'll be like, well, at the end of the day. And I can always sort of hear like Valerie, you know, crossing that out. And I think she's technically right. But I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, the part of what you learn to do is you put yourself into the writing, but you also recognize it's not yours. It belongs to somebody else. It's different than writing a book.
So how many speeches would you say you had written for President Obama before he knew your name?
I'd probably written a dozen, something like that. I started, as we've talked about, writing for the senior staff, and then I went to the campaign, and I was writing
The 2012 campaign.
And I was writing exclusively for President Obama, but from the Democratic National Committee headquarters. And my job was kind of to do the campaign speeches no one else wanted to do. So they were very small. I wasn't meeting with the president. And then in 2013, I got promoted to full-time presidential speechwriter. And that's when, you know, that was the first time I was kind of regularly going into the Oval Office to talk to President Obama about his edits or thoughts.
At least in the Obama White House, it seems as if all or almost all of the speechwriters fit your exact demographic. These are young white men, most of them still in their 20s. Guys who went to elite colleges, guys who were pretty funny, maybe not funny enough to make it in Hollywood, but funny. And it kind of bugs me. I don't even know why, but that fact bugs me. Maybe it suggests a certain kind of myopia. Why do you think so many of the same type of people ended up in that same job?
Well, over time, the composition of the Obama White House and of the speechwriting team changed a lot. So that's one of the things I write about in the book, that I do think it was, you know, it's always tricky because it was kind of regrettable that when I started on the speechwriting team, we were sort of overwhelmingly white and male, but also, like, I was fine with this particular white male being added to the group. So it's a little bit challenging. But one of the things that I am impressed by in the Obama White House was that the speechwriting team and the team more broadly that ended in, you know, 2016 was way more diverse in a variety of different ways than the team that sort of started out. And that was not an accident. That was people saying the same thing, I think, that you had, that, you know, we're missing something here, and we're going to actually not just talk about bringing on people from different perspectives, but we're going to do it. So, you know, I think that I think it's hard. I think that speech writing, now I do, you know, a fair amount of comedy writing, there's sort of similar worlds where you don't just end up with diversity by accident. You have to prioritize it. And so I'm proud that I was part of an organization that did prioritize it, even if we didn't always start out in the right place.
Ilya Marritz in today for Leonard Lopate. My guest is David Litt. His book is Thanks Obama, My Hopey Change Years in the White House. He was an Obama speechwriter. And I'm wondering, within the speechwriting team, there really was a pecking order and kind of a stable. How does the system work, and how do you sort of find your place in that system?
Every White House is different when it comes to how the whole thing works, but also how the speechwriting shop works. For us, it tended to be that the chief speechwriter would kind of dole out assignments, and generally speaking, based on seniority, people could choose what they wanted. But sometimes there were exceptions. So I think I was pretty lucky where, because I was kind of our token in-house funny person starting in about 2012, there were speeches that just naturally I ended up doing that maybe were more fun or were sort of higher profile than I would have otherwise gotten to write. I wrote a lot of speeches that were directed at the American Jewish community because I spent 8 years going to Hebrew school and sort of wondering, why am I doing this? And then a speech or two came up and I was like, oh, this was why. You know, this is my chance to kind of use some of that Hebrew school knowledge and combine it with some of the things the president's been saying. So those moments where you kind of develop a sense of a specialty, like this is something that I could do that probably no one else in the building could do by circumstance more than because of talent, but it's still, those are the things you hold on to.
You write about being assigned an infrastructure speech, which was a new kind of a topic for you, and how you actually really had to study up for that and talk with a lot of area experts before you started writing. And you hand in this draft and you're really proud of it, but things sort of go downhill from there. What happened?
Well, I probably dove a little too deep into the nitty-gritty of infrastructure finance.
And I should say this was like a bridge in Florida?
This was a tunnel in Florida. Yeah, get your infrastructure right, please. there were a tunnel connecting the port of Miami to the city. And I could still bore you to death about this particular port project, which is exactly the problem. That one of the things that speechwriters, especially presidential speechwriters, should be doing is kind of being professional dilettantes. You want to know something about everything, but if you know too much, you lose sight of what's interesting, especially when the audience is the entire country. And so the speech I wrote was, you know, had a lot to do with like advances in dredging technology, some really fascinating stuff. But when I sent it to my boss, Cody Keenan, he rewrote it so it became a speech about America and about jobs and about some things that were much broader and more, connected with the audience, just way better than the speech that I had written. And it was a good learning experience for me, realizing that if you're writing for, you know, maybe a deputy cabinet secretary, you can be very laser focused on one issue because you don't have another audience of people who are watching this on TV or who are putting this in this national context. For the president, every audience is the entire United States.
And every speech is about America.
Every speech is about America.
It's so interesting because you started when you were 24, which made you, I guess, the youngest. But most speechwriters, it seems, start pretty young in their 20s. And exactly like that, are really learning on the job. Why is that a job where it helps to be a person who's learning on the job?
So I don't think I was even the youngest speechwriter. I was among the youngest. The speechwriting team in general skewed young because President Obama was so young when he ran, and his chief speechwriter, Jon Favreau, was so young. He was 27 when he became the chief speechwriter at the White House. I think that one of the reasons speechwriting tends to be a job that young people fall into is the same thing we just talked about. You don't have to be a subject matter expert with 20 years of experience and a PhD. You have to be very good at being curious and learning little bits about things, but you can do that faster than you can become a true expert in a specific field.
Have you met or had any contact with any of President Trump's speechwriters?
I can't say as I have, no.
Then none of them reached out to you?
This may surprise you, but none of them reached out to me.
What did you make of Donald Trump's inaugural speech, which included that memorable phrase, American carnage?
Well, I will say, during the inauguration itself, it also happened to be my fiance's birthday, so we went to Disney World. We were like, we are going somewhere where we're not going to see any televisions. I will go back and read the speech afterward.
And you weren't checking Twitter during your fiance's birthday?
I'm gonna dodge your question. Twitter may have been checked. I don't know. But the thing that really disappoints me and upsets me about that speech, not just as a Democrat but as an American, is that I do think this is a huge break with tradition, where the American president has, part of their job has always been to describe the best version of the country we can be, and President Trump's objective seems to be to describe the worst version of the country we can be, so that then he can go in and say, I alone can fix it. And I guess politically that worked for him well enough that he got elected, you know, thanks to the Electoral College, but it's not healthy for the country. It's certainly not good for America, because it gives him a perverse incentive to make America worse in order for him to be able to go back and say, look at all the problems.
He might also say, I don't know if he'd express it quite this way, but he might also say, I communicate directly to the American people through my Twitter account, and that's the best way to communicate. Now, you were part of a team that really believed in the importance of speeches and oratory, but I do wonder whether speeches are becoming a bit of a relic. Hardly anybody who's not a journalist or isn't in the audience at a speech is going to watch the whole thing from start to finish and really digest it that way.
The Obama White House, I think, started off saying, you know, the main two tools for a president are interviews and speeches. But I was part of a team, and more importantly, got to witness our digital team really rethink the way that presidents communicate. So in addition to our Twitter account, which was a little, you know, more complete sentence heavy than President Trump's, but was still a way of communicating directly, we had, you know, a lot of people thinking about Facebook video. We had, I write about Zach Galifianakis coming in to do Between Two Ferns with President Obama about healthcare, which I thought was a terrible idea. And of course, I was 100% wrong. And the way that presidents get their message across is going to have to change. Speeches, I think, will continue to be important. You know, if there's a tragedy, we still go to the TV and we want to see what the president has to say. And also, I think speeches are underrated as a internal communications tool for the federal government. So the government is huge. Oftentimes a speech is a way for people throughout the government to say, what should I be focusing on today? Well, I can go back to what the president said in the State of the Union, and I know what his or her priorities are. And so there are things that speeches will continue to do, but they're not going to be the only tool or the main tool in the way that they were 10 years ago.
Now, at one point in the 2012 reelection campaign, you got the super interesting assignment to write speeches for two actresses, Kerry Washington and Scarlett Johansson. And interestingly enough, coming this week, that brought you into contact with Harvey Weinstein. Tell me how that went.
Well, yeah, I should say even the phrase brought you into contact with Harvey Weinstein has changed a little bit. So part of my job was to kind of keep him happy. He was in Los Angeles. I was in Charlotte for the convention. So he was on the phone.
And he had sort of wrangled the actresses effectively for
this
convention.
Yeah, he was sort of the behind-the-scenes figure who I was told had kind of organized this whole thing as a rebuttal to Clint Eastwood's rambling speech at the Republican convention the week earlier.
Right.
And so my job was to keep him happy, and I was not very good at my job.
He
let me know. I mean, it was the kind of thing where I wrote about it the way I remembered it at the time, which is being yelled at Harvey Weinstein by Harvey Weinstein was kind of this surreal but harmless experience. And now, obviously, it sort of seems like it's still relatively harmless. Obviously, a lot of worse things came to light, but it was the kind of thing where I look back on it and say, okay, that maybe seems like a glimpse into something a lot more sinister than just one guy who has, you know, anger management issues.
He wanted to also control Kerry Washington's and Scarlett Johansson's speeches, and that was really your job to keep an eye on what they were going to be saying that night.
Well, yeah, and it was also, I should say, it was their job, too, that they were in control of, like any principal, it's their words. But it was, I mean, looking back on it, like the amount of influence that he had, I the way I approached it was, is it worth going through all this effort to make a big donor happy because they're contributing money to the campaign? And my conclusion was essentially, yeah, that politics is not always idealistic in that way, but it was probably worth my time. My time was not that valuable. It's one of those things where now looking back on it, that seems like probably the less important question, and the amount of kind of influence and power he exerted and the way he abused that power, you know, this is not the... it was strange to sort of have my own Harvey Weinstein story in there that is totally on several orders of magnitude less horrific. But it also is one of those moments where you write something down in a book and then the book is still the same, but events move on and things appear different.
Right. You could have written he was an angel and hope, you write jokes, you're in entertainment, that he would maybe smile upon you one day for a movie deal.
Yeah,
so it's to your credit that you give an honest accounting of how that was.
I don't think if I had written, you know, Harvey Weinstein never yelled at anybody, I don't think anyone in Los Angeles would have believed that. But it's true. I did have that thought of like, should I leave this out because this is a powerful person? And I felt like it was important to keep in for different reasons at the time than it now seems worthwhile, but I guess I'm glad it's in there.
You write that there was this sense of phoniness that dogged you while you were working in the White House, and that it actually seemed to increase as your years went by and as your seniority went by. And I just wonder why that was, that you were worried about phoniness as you gained experience and stature there.
Well, I think there's a fundamental contradiction at the heart of any job like a White House job, which is you're a human being, you make mistakes, but you have, even if you're a mid-level speechwriter, an outsized influence over other people. Your words matter way more than you would expect. And living in that paradox is difficult. And I think all public figures do it in some way, and they deal with it in different ways. But one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was that I do feel like there's a sense that everybody who works in the White House is sort of supremely confident and always good at their job and never worries whether they belong. And I want to make sure that people who have some doubt and have some concern about, am I in the right place, still feel like, yeah, I can make a difference. I can do a job like that.
It's been reported that since leaving office, that Barack Obama has recently been giving highly paid speeches, you know, the big bucks, Wall Street kind of speeches, Carlyle Group, Cantor Fitzgerald. Do you think that erodes his stature?
I don't personally think so. I mean, to me, the key questions are, what's he saying to those audiences? And what he's been saying is the same stuff he's been saying for his entire public life. And also, what kind of person is he now that he's in the private sector? And so one of the things that I've pointed out when I was asked about this, I think on TV or something like that, was that, you know, he's, at the same time he's taking money to give speeches, he's also giving a lot of money to like schools on the south side of Chicago. I would be totally fine saying, if he's going to take money from Wall Street and give money to, you know, poor kids who need school supplies, that seems to me like a pretty reasonable trade-off.
What about you? Are you still writing speeches?
I do occasionally, but one of the reasons I don't do full-time speechwriting anymore is just because I feel like I had the best speechwriting job anyone's possibly going to get, certainly for a generation. And so I wanted to try to do something different, and I did sort of sit down and think, well, I kind of want to know what I sound like, and the audience is going to be way smaller for a book I write even than compared to the least important speech I wrote, but it still is fun, and it felt worthwhile to try to process what had happened and what it meant.
How does it compare writing a book in your own voice to writing a speech for somebody else?
It was way less pressure, because to me, if my book was no good, it wouldn't really matter to the world. It would just matter to me personally. But it was also in some ways emotionally more challenging, because there wasn't that veneer of, if it goes poorly, it's not me who gets criticized. And so there was this sense, and you know, obviously it's a memoir with my name on the cover. If people don't like it, it does feel a little bit like a personal rejection, in a way that writing a speech that doesn't go as well as you think it could wouldn't feel. So, I think it was challenging in different ways, but it was certainly nice not to feel the pressure of going into work every day thinking, if I do my job poorly, in some way I'm letting the President of the United States down. I don't think anything's going to compare to just either the highs or the lows of working in that kind of environment.
I suppose you can take a few more risks as well. Express a few more opinions.
That's right. A lot more swear words in my book.
Quite a few swear words.
Yeah,
that you'll never see in a speech or hear on the radio.
I think I don't know if I set the record for swear words in a White House book, but I'd like to think I do.
I'm Ilya Meretz, filling in for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with David Litt, President Obama's speechwriter, former speechwriter, about his book, Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. David, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.